In the times of the Rishonim, there were many Rishonim who made lists of what they believed were the Taryag mitzvahs. How exactly do you figure out what are the 613 mitzvahs? And you'll say, first of all, the Ramban asked the question, who made up this premise that there are 613 mitzvahs? Who said that that's true? We have a Gemara that seems to indicate that there are 613 mitzvahs, but the Ramban questions whether or not that is actually the case, or should we assume maybe there are more, maybe there are less? But the basic assumption of most of the Rishonim is that there are 613 mitzvahs, and that leads them to try and figure out how exactly they are going to categorize these mitzvahs and what is considered to be part of the count and what is considered to be out of the count. The issue is, let's say the Ramban takes out a number of mitzvahs that the Rambam put in his count, so then the Ramban is stuck. How does he make up the list that he took away from what the Rambam wrote? In the beginning of that discussion of what the Taryag mitzvahs are, the Rambam writes his opinion very clearly, both in Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph from Hilchos Tefillah, that is the very first Halacha in Hilchos Tefillah, as well as in the Sefer HaMitzvahs Mitzvah Hei, where the Rambam clearly states that he believes that everybody has a biblical obligation to daven each and every day. We have an obligation based on the Pasuk that says, Ula'avdo b'chal levavchem, which means we have to serve Hashem with all our hearts. Says the Rambam, that means, Zu Tefillah, Ezihui avoda shebelev. What is the way to serve as God with your heart? That is through Tefillah. And therefore, says the Rambam, we assume that the mitzvah of tefillah is an absolute chiyuv, it's a mitzvah d'oraisa, and that is clearly the Rambam's opinion. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, is strongly opposed to this assumption of the Rambam. The Ramban disagrees and feels, no, this is a mitzvah midrabanan, you cannot include this in the mitzvah d'oraisa at all, this cannot be one of the 613 when you're trying to figure out what the count is. And the Ramban is now stuck. How does he explain the pasuk ula'avdo b'chal levavchem? You should serve Hashem with all your heart, and that generally is understood to mean Avodas HaTfilah, that's the way to service God with your heart. So the Ramban argues and he says, no, that Pasuk La'avda B'chalavavchem is referring to a mitzvah klalis. And that is, says the Ramban, Iker HaKasiv La'avda B'chalavavchem, Shatiyah Kol Avodoseinu Lakel Yizbarach, that we should have the feeling that everything we do is for the Ribono Shel Olam. Every time we perform a mitzvah, we give all that we have to the Ribono Shel Olam. We give everything, all of our senses, all of our feelings. That's what it means, La'avda B'chalavavchem. Not specifically tefillah, but rather the mitzvah experience that we have throughout the year to do anything that we're asked to do has to be b'chal levavchem, has to be with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, and that's what the Ramban understands this pasuk to be indicating. The Ramban does write, though, that tefillah, he agrees, might be a mitzvah when a person finds himself in an eis tzara. The Torah does mandate us, biblically, to perform the mitzvah of tefillah when a person finds himself in a crisis, in a situation of emergency, in a predicament. So then the Ramban says, if it's an eis tzara, we have an obligation, midaraisa, a biblical obligation to sin. The Ramban think that this should be counted as one of the Taryag mitzvahs HaTorah at all. So Rav Soloveitchik explained that the Rambam doesn't disagree with that premise. The Rambam agrees that the only time tefillah is daraisa is when it's an eis tzara, but the Rambam's outlook was that life is so fickle that every moment of life is considered an emergency. Every day of our lives, we know, is so transient, is so unpredictable, is so volatile, we know that there's no assumptions. We know that life is not assumed that it's going to be the same way tomorrow as it is today. I could not stop when I thought about this point from Rav Soloveitchik. Anybody who watched the video from a few days ago of the ramming attack in Yerushalayim, such an awful, such a terrible video, but anybody who saw it, how can you not think about the fact that 30 seconds before that, all of them were just peacefully enjoying their company, enjoying the fact that they had families, enjoying the fact that they had people who they loved so much and who loved them. And then out of nowhere, life is so unpredictable. Life is so erratic sometimes, as we know. And that's exactly what the Rambam says. How many of those people would have thought that that night their children would be orphans? Who would have thought of such a thing? Who thinks like that? Certainly when they're 20 years old, nobody thinks like that. And that's what, unfortunately, all the casualties were, such young people. And yet, Rav Soloveitchik writes, that's why we have to develop the understanding, the feeling, that when we have the opportunity to daven every day, the Rambam, who feels that this is a mitzvah d'oraisa, also agrees that tefillah is only to be stated when we have an eis tzara, when we feel ourselves in a state of emergency. But the Rambam's hashkafa is that every moment of life is an emergency. Every moment of life is a crisis. There's a sense of urgency that a person should feel at any moment, at any day of life, because we know that life is so unpredictable, that life is so arbitrary sometimes, and we have no control over what life might bring us. So that is, just with regard to this discussion about whether tefillah is d'oraisa, tefillah is d'rabbanan, again, a very rich discussion. The way the Magen Avraham understands it is that it's a machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban, whether tefillah is d'oraisa, d'rabbanan. But either way, everybody agrees that we have a mitzvah every day to daven. If it's biblical or rabbinic, shouldn't really matter. We have a mitzvah every day to daven. The Ramban does make a comment, which I think is worth mentioning. The Ramban has this comment on Chumash. The Beis Yosef quotes it as well in Hilchos Yantif, Sim Tav Pei Zayin, that even if you believe that the Ramban is correct, that we only have a mitzvah de Rabbanon to daven, but it's not really considered a biblical obligation, the Ramban feels that on Yomtiv, we have a biblical obligation to daven. Now, sometimes Yomtiv, we're so busy, we're preparing the food and we're doing whatever has to be done, and we don't have the chance to daven, but there, says the Ramban, even I agree that it's a mitzvah d'oraisa, because the pasuk says, Mikra Kodesh, you have an obligation to call the day a sanctified day. Now, how do you do that? How do you consider a day? How do you make it sanctified? Says the Ramban, part of being a Mikra Kodesh, an assembly of Kedusha, is when everybody comes together and we daven together. So therefore, says the Ramban, that even I, who believes that tefillah in general is only rabbinic in its very nature, the Ramban himself argues that when it comes to tefillah on Yom Tov, that might be a mitzvah d'oraisa. You know, this past week we just commemorated Aseret B'Teves. And Aseret B'Teves is one of the commemorations that we have which led up to the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And we have a number of them throughout the year which make us remind ourselves of what the Beis HaMikdash was and what we're lacking without a Beis HaMikdash. If you would ask someone, what exactly are we missing without a Beis HaMikdash? They would say, we're missing the Avodah. We're missing the fact that we cannot offer Karbanos. A person does a mistake, a person violates an Avera, they bring a Karban to make good for what they did wrong. A person feels a sense of gratitude, they bring a Karban Todah. There are many different Karbanos that we offer for different feelings, for different emotions, a way to express ourselves in the form of a Karban. And we say that's what we're missing without a Beis HaMikdash. But in fact, the Rambam writes something which is so surprising. The Rambam has not only Svarim that detail the mitzvahs and Svarim that talk about the halacha, but the Rambam has a sefer on Jewish philosophy as well. And that is what the Rambam's famous work, the Mor Nevuchim. In the Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam writes a very controversial statement. The Ramban takes major issue with this passage in the Rambam, but I think it's a very enlightening piece in the Rambam. The Rambam says, what is main avoda that we all have? What exactly is the main focus? Why do we have Karbanos at all, says the Rambam? The Rambam says that Karbanos is not really the pinnacle of spiritual experience, of spiritual expression. It's not what we would have thought. We feel we're missing a Beis HaMikdash. We cannot have the apex of spiritual existence. We cannot have the relationship that we're supposed to have because I cannot offer Karbanos. Says the Rambam, no. Do you know why Karbanos were instituted, the Rambam says? Karbanos were instituted because the Jewish people were looking around at their very friendly neighbors and they saw all the other Umas HaOlam, all the Ovdei Avodah Zarah, have the opportunity to express themselves in a form of a Karban. They have a way to let out their feelings by giving an offering to their gods. The Jewish people felt bad. How come we don't have that chance? How come we don't have that feeling? Why don't we have the experience of doing that as well? And God said, you know what? I'm going to give you the chance to do that as well. I'm going to give you all of those very detailed, intricate halachas about Karbanos, and this way you're going to be able to do the same as everybody else. But says the Rambam, that's the second fiddle. The real avoda that a person's supposed to be feeling, the real avoda, the way to express oneself to the Ribono Shel Olam, is really, first and foremost, through tefillah. And says the Rambam in Hilchos Tefillah, not with this Mor Nevuchim, but the Rambam writes in Hilchos Tefillah, that the Beis HaMikdash was the place where the tefillahs were offered. The Beis HaMikdash is referred to as Beis Beis Tefillah Yikari L'Chala Amim. How would you categorize, how would you classify the Beis HaMikdash? I would not have said that that is a Beis Tefillah. I would not have said that the Beis HaMikdash is a place of offering our prayers. I would have said it's a place of offering our sacrifices. But says the Rambam, no. The Pasuk comes to teach us that it's first and foremost a Beis Tefillah. That what we're lacking without a Beis HaMikdash is the fact that we don't have the opportunity to express ourselves on the highest level in Tefillah, in the most consecrated place, in the Makam HaMikdash, where we have the closest relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. What we miss, what we lack without a Beis HaMikdash, is not just the simple Karbanos, the sacrifices as we all would have thought, but rather we're missing the very fundamental opportunity that we have to express ourselves in tefillah. The Beis HaMikdash is a Beis Tefillah, first and foremost, before anything else, is the lacking of the spiritual experience of having the most appropriate tefillah that we can offer. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so I think you're in good company, because the Ramban actually writes that the Divrei HaRambam are Divrei Havai. He says these are nonsense. He goes really wild against this Rambam, and he thinks it's a very controversial statement, and he thinks it's wrong. How can you say all the psukim in the Chumash that describe all the avodas hakarbanos are just coincidental? It just happens to be that we found that the other nations of the world were doing this, and now God made us gave us a booby prize. He decided to make us happy and give us the same opportunity. Hard to say such a thing. Ramban really has very strong opposition to this assumption of the Rambam. But again, this is the opinion of the Rambam. And the Rambam says, you're saying that if the Rambam feels that tefillah is the most fundamental aspect of the Beis HaMikdash, how come he just happens to learn it from a pasuk which is not even clear? La'avda b'chalav avchem, the Rambam disagrees whether it's even introducing tefillah at all. It's a good question. It's an important question. But that's the opinion of the Rambam, and that's the way he feels. But I think the takeaway from that is the fact that sometimes we think about the lacking of Beis HaMikdash, sometimes, most of us don't think about it that often, myself included, but when we do have the chance to think about the lacking of Beis HaMikdash in our lives, at least let's think about what are we lacking without the Beis HaMikdash. We're not lacking just what you would have thought. We're not lacking just the fact that we don't have a place to sacrifice and to express ourselves in karbanas, but rather we're lacking the fact that we don't have the highest level of prayer that we possibly can have. And this is why the Rambam writes in Hilchos Tefillah that when a person davens, they have to be mechavin keneged beis kodesh hakadoshim. A person has to have their mind directed toward the kodesh hakadoshim. Why is that such an important part of tefillah? And Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that it would seem that that's part of the daraisa aspect of tefillah, is not only to daven, not only how to daven, but also to daven in the facing the direction of the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Why is that included in the more fundamental aspects of tefillah? That would seem to be incidental, but no. The Rambam tells us that that's the most important part of tefillah because that's what the Beis HaMikdash is. Beis HaMikdash represents the place where all the tefillah niskabel, where all of our tefillahs were answered, and that's what we lack without a Beis HaMikdash. So whether you assume that tefillah is a mitzvah d'araisa, whether you assume it's a mitzvah d'rabbanan, we all assume that tefillah is something that we're expected to do. It's a mitzvah like any other, and it's something that we are all expected to do. But here I gave you a passage from Rav Soloveitchik, and here I think once again, last week I got a lot of responses that people very much appreciated the piece that we read through together, and I think this is also in line with that one. This is an article that Rav Soloveitchik wrote called Prayer, Petition, and Crisis. And here Rav Soloveitchik breaks down again how to explain, how to understand what the act of tefillah is in its core and how it's fundamentally different from many other mitzvah activities that we do. Once again, Rav Soloveitchik expresses himself so beautifully, just magnificent, the way he lays it out here. This article is about 30 pages long, so I took the most important aspects of what I thought he writes there. And when we read through this, you'll understand why it is. You know, I've been getting some people who have responded that they're upset. We are supposed to have a halacha class here, and we've been talking a lot about hashkafa and the essence of prayer. What about the halacha of tefillah? What about all of that? I think when we read through this piece from Rav Soloveitchik, we'll understand why it is important that we spend a long time thinking about the essence and the nature and the fundamental aspects of what prayer is before we get into the act itself, before we get into the nitty-gritty details of what exactly tefillah requires of us. It's important to think about the mindset that tefillah mandates from us as well. So let's begin as follows. Again, Rav Soloveitchik here in the piece entitled Prayer, Petition, and Crisis writes as follows. Line number one. In contradistinction to the actional mitzvahs, which form a single objective series, again, Rav Soloveitchik here draws a distinction between different categories of mitzvahs. So as we know, we have a category of mitzvahs which he calls actional mitzvahs, such as shaking the lulav, blowing the shofar, lighting the Shabbos candles. We have many activities that we're expected to do. This is how you do it, and you look in Shulchan Aruch, it tells you exactly how to do it, and don't pick the lulav upside down, and don't have it sideways, and shake it around this way, and there's very defined measurements of how exactly you're supposed to perform those actional mitzvahs. So again, in contradistinction to the actional mitzvahs, which form a single objective series, meaning everybody has to do it exactly like this. Everybody has to shake the lulav exactly this way. You have to pick it up that way and make the bracha now. Don't make the bracha then. Make a bracha before. Make a bracha after. Everything is very clear cut. The experiential mitzvahs, which he considers a different category, refer to a spiritual act, a state of mind, an inner attitude or an outlook. So says of Soloveitchik, we have two different categories of mitzvahs. One are the actional mitzvahs, shaking the lulav, blowing the shofar. And then we have the experiential mitzvahs, as he will explain. The norm originates not in the world of action, but in the world of thought, feeling, and volition. When you think about those experiential mitzvahs, it's supposed to be an inward activity. The halacha enters a new dimension of human life, that of subjectivity and inwardness. In contrast to actional mitzvahs, the experiential mitzvahs postulate a way not only of doing, but of experiencing as well. The halacha attempts to regulate not only the body, but also the soul. So again, we have a halachic system that is set up, and the halacha doesn't only dictate how we're supposed to act. When one goes to the bathroom and you have to make an asher yatzar, halacha says this is the way you're supposed to do it. When one davens in the morning, this is the way you're supposed to do it. Everything that we do is dictated, every action that we have is dictated by the halacha. Even the most mundane of activities that we're involved in are governed by the laws of the halacha. But yet the halacha goes so much further than that. It doesn't only regulate our body, but it says in Soloveitchik, it regulates the feeling, it regulates the heart and the soul as well. And those are what we call experiential mitzvahs, the chovos halavavos. We'll see in a minute exactly what he means. And he breaks it down a little bit further, again, skipping a few pages in between these two paragraphs, but you'll take my word for it that these are the most important parts of what he wrote. Line number 10, first, there are inward actions that form a single subjective experience without calling for outward action at all. The inner stirring does not press for portrayal or symbolization in objective form and remains shut in within the human heart, remote from the world of events, wanting in contour and aloof from the concreteness. Again, what that means is, in English, that sometimes we have, the halacha regulates how we're supposed to think and how we're supposed to feel, but it doesn't tell us to do anything with that feeling. We're supposed to keep that feeling inside and just think about it and feel it and experience it. And you're not asked to shake a lulav as a result of that feeling, and you're not asked to do anything else as a result of that feeling. All you're asked to do is keep that feeling inside and understand what the feeling means to you, what the experience is supposed to do to your personality. Sometimes one receives an unlimited amount of pleasure and contemplation that has no practical significance. You think about a young child. Young child very often fantasizes. Why do adults not do it? Because we have better things to do, right? We have more important things to do than just to fantasize about something that is not material, that is not ever going to come to a reality. So you have children who fantasize and who imagine. Why is it enjoyable to fantasize? But they know it's never going to be. Because that's pleasurable, to think about something. Even if you don't act it out, you don't do anything about it. But that's a very pleasurable activity. What would I do if I had X? If I won the lottery? Do we ever think about that? Once in a while we think about it. Why do we think about it? What's the probability that it's going to happen? Almost nothing. But we think about it because it's fun. And here he says the same thing. The halacha sometimes gives us the opportunity to fantasize. I don't want you to do anything with that feeling, with that fantasy. I don't want you to do any expressive activity with the experience that you're having. Just have the experience. Just savor the moment. Just enjoy it. Somebody told me before my wedding, I think it was the greatest piece of advice, that don't get lost in the fantasy. Remind yourself a few times throughout your wedding that you're actually getting married. This is a tremendous moment in your life. Don't let the whole evening pass by without recognizing what's happening, because sometimes that happens to us. We get lost in a fantasy, we get lost in all the glitz and everything else, and we forget about what does this experience actually mean to me? What is happening at this moment of my life? I'm getting very excited with everything that's going on around me, but I don't really take the few moments to think about how this is going to play out and what it's going to do for me, and what a major moment this is in my life. So here, line number 15. Sometimes one receives an unlimited amount of pleasure and contemplation that has no practical significance in a pensive mood, devoid of dynamics, and apprehending something that is an endless distance from actuality and definiteness. The dominant role in such experiences is either their other sublimity and tenderness, which would be affected if put into the mold of objectification. Again, it would take away if you would try to objectify that and put it into an action. You cannot bottle up the feelings that you have. First time you become a grandparent, first time you become a parent, how can you express what you're feeling at that time? There's no way of bottling up that feeling and putting it into anything. We just had a 50th wedding anniversary for my parents, and the one thing my mother said when she came back was, I wish I could put all of those feelings in a bottle and save it. But you can't. But you can't. That's not the way life works. Sometimes a feeling that you have is so overwhelming, is so powerful, there's no way to bottle all of those experiences up and put them away for later. Because that would take away. That would take away from the feeling that you have at that moment. Line 21. Or their tremendous sweep and power which does not tolerate fixity and standardization. Again, what it means is that sometimes we have powerful moments in life that we cannot bottle up, that we cannot put into an action. We're expected just to feel it, just to experience it, and to leave it at just that. Be that as it may, line 23, such mitzvahs are realized by the heart, not by the hand. The activity of the mind is filled with religious worth, but the body does not participate in that realization. We subsume under this category the fundamental precepts of our faith, such as the commandment to believe in God's unity. So you're supposed to believe in Yichud Hashem, that God is Yachid and Yichud, He's the only one. What do we do about that feeling that we have? For the few of us who are great tzaddikim and tzidkaniyos who actually have that feeling, most of us I would imagine, have a hard time even thinking about that. But for those of us who are successful in really understanding that and having it mean something meaningful to us, what do we do about that feeling? So now you've established that God is the Yachid and Meyuchad, He's the overall overarching power in your life. Now what? Do you do anything about that feeling? No, you're not expected to do anything. It's something you're supposed to experience. It's something you cannot express. To love and fear Him, to trust in Him. So you have Emunah b'HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does that mean, you have Emunah? What do you do about the feeling that you have in Emunah? Nothing. It's an inner strength that you feel. It's an inner connection. It's a relationship that you have. Among others, these precepts, using Rabbeinu Bechaya's phrase in his 11th century work, Duties of the Heart, better known as Chovos HaLevavos, the famous Sefer Chovos HaLevavos, written by Rabbeinu Bechaya, are concerned with the Chovos HaLevavos, not with those of the limbs. Why is the Sefer called Chovos HaLevavos? Because it describes the feelings that we're supposed to have inside of our heart, inside of our soul, not with the outward activities that the Shulchan Aruch describes. The Chovos HaLevavos is a very different venue. It's a very different instruction. It's an instruction not on how to act, but how to think and how to feel, how to experience. Faith in God, line 31. Faith in God, commitment and love to Him do not require specific symbolic actions for the purpose of objectification or manifestation of the inward experience. Maimonides, better known as the Rambam, in his introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvos, calls such precepts mitzvos klalius, general commandments. Why is that called a mitzvah klalius? Because that's the foundation of all mitzvahs. If you don't have Avas Hashem, why are you performing any of His mitzvahs? If you don't care for Him, if you don't have a relationship with Him, then what is the whole Torah worth to you? You're just doing the act without the experience? What is that? Says the Rambam, we refer to that as a mitzvah klali, ones which have no specific correlate in the objective religious sense. You cannot say that a given mitzvah that you perform is an expression of your Avas Hashem. Avas Hashem is so much greater than the lulav that you take. Is so much more profound than the Shabbos candles that you light, than the Shabbos that you keep, than the Yom Tov that you observe, than the Kiddush that you make. The feelings of Avas Hashem are so overwhelming, so much more so than any given act that a person might do on any day of the year. Line 37, the mitzvah klaliyos lean upon the whole body of the law and are related to a mental attitude rather than an outward deed. In short, the general precepts refer to contemplative experiences that do not cross the gulf separating our inner world from that of action. So, if that's true, Rav Soloveitchik is now bothered with the following question. If it's true that Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem and Yichud Hashem and all your feelings and relationships that you have with God or you're supposed to have are just inward activities, well then why was the Torah given with such very precise rules? Why do we have any actional mitzvahs at all? Would it not have been easier if God told us, well, on the occasion of Sukkot once a year, I want you to go, don't sit in the Sukkot. That's a big pain in the neck for you to build a sukkah and buy the sukkah. It's going to cost you a lot of money. Sometimes it's cold outside. Sometimes it's too hot. Sometimes there are mosquitoes. It's very difficult. Instead, I want you to sit in a corner every year on the occasion of sukkahs and just think about all the miracles that were performed in the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Basukkahs hoshavti es b'nei Yisrael b'otzios ha'meretz Mitzrayim. Think about the experience of what sukkah should be. Don't sit in the sukkah. And you know, for that matter, don't light the Hanukkah candles on Hanukkah. I want you just every year, once a year, 8 nights, I want you to sit and think on your couch. Do it in a relaxed fashion, sequester yourself, nobody else should see you. Sit and meditate by yourself all alone about what exactly transpired so many thousands of years ago and how grateful you are for those miracles and for the miracles that you are experiencing in your life as well. Why don't we have just a whole religion of meditation, of contemplation? Why do we ever need to do any action, any activity? If the same way the Torah says, Avas Hashem is an experience that you're supposed to feel, nothing that you act upon, and Yiras Hashem is the same thing, and Emunah b'Hashem is that experience as well, is that feeling. So then why do we ever have an obligation to perform any mitzvahs? Life would have been much simpler if I wouldn't have to run around and buy the matzahs and buy the maror and start checking everything. Why do I have to do any of this? Says Rav Soloveitchik, line 42, very profound point. The halacha is distrustful of the genuineness and depth of our inner life. The halacha is distrustful of the genuineness and depth of our inner life. So what would happen if God would have said, I want you to sit on the couch every year on Hanukkah, on Sukkot, on Pesach, and just think about what the experience is. How many of us would be able to do that without being interrupted 5 minutes later by all the million other things that are going on in our lives and flying through our minds? God understands human nature. Unless I give you a mitzvah, an act to do, you won't be able to keep to the Torah because it's just too difficult. So the whole religion couldn't just be an experiential feeling, a way to contemplate and meditate with oneself, because that would amount to nothing. As we said last week, those who are involved in Kiruv have told me that if you give people the opportunity to just sit by themselves and express themselves to the Ribbono Shel Olam, they don't yet know how to read Hebrew, so you tell them, sit in a room by yourself. Tefillah is the opportunity for you to express yourself to the Ribbono Shel Olam, to talk and communicate with him. He'll listen to whatever you say. You now have an hour to say whatever you'd like, whatever is on your mind. Ask him for anything you'd like. Talk to him about anything that's bothering you. How many people would fill that hour with what to say to the Ribbono Shel Olam? I can fill an hour talking to anybody else, but I can't fill an hour relating and connecting with the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's just too difficult. My mind is all over the place. My mind is wandering. I don't know how to collect my thoughts in a proper way to really get my thoughts clearly articulated to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's perhaps why we have a sitter, like we said last week, that the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah did the job for us, because, as Rav Soloveitchik says, the halacha is distrustful of the genuineness and depth of our inner life. If we had an hour every day to sit by ourselves, and don't daven, just sit by yourself and think about what the relationship of Emunah B'Hashem actually means to you. What does Yerushalayim mean to you? I don't think many of us would fill up the hour. Line 43. Because of its vagueness, transience, and volatility, therefore it has introduced as a favor to us. It has introduced as a favor to us. You want to understand how to have a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam? Don't just sit and think about it. I'm going to give you certain activities to help you have a medium to connect with me. In the realm of experiential norm, concrete media through which a religious feeling manifests itself in the form of a concrete act. That is a favor, a chesed elyon that was done for us. Because if we only had the feeling and the experience, we would never be able to connect in the proper way. And that's why the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the mitzvahs as a medium and a very concrete act to connect with him. For instance, he says, the precept of rejoicing on a festival, Simchas Yom Tov. That's a great example. We have a mitzvah to be mesameach on Pesach, on Shavuos, on Sukkot. A question whether Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur as well. How can you celebrate if it's Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? You're supposed to have the Emes Yom Hadin, a whole discussion. But basically, you're supposed to have a feeling of Simchas Yom Tov. That should be a very simple thing for us to do. Go celebrate Yom Tov. Go spend the whole experience of Sukkot having a great time. Why does the Torah dictate exactly how I'm supposed to celebrate? Why is it your business how I celebrate? If I enjoy doing something, why am I mandated by what the Torah's rules are for celebration? We have a mitzvah of Simchas Yom Tov. Let me figure out how to do it. Says of Soloveitchik, rejoicing on a festival, Simchas Yom Tov, is realized through a double activity. It's a feeling one is supposed to have inside of them, but in order to manage those feelings, in order to make them come through, the Torah says this is how to do it. This is the ingredients of how one brings themselves to a feeling of simcha. Experiencing the redeeming, uplifting, and inspiring joy on the one hand, and conforming to the external cultic standard of bringing shlamim offerings and feastings on the other hand. How can the Torah tell me that the way to celebrate is to bring a carbon to the Beis HaMikdash? Maybe I don't enjoy that. Maybe I would enjoy sitting in my house on the couch doing something else. But yet the Torah expects a dual experience here. On the one hand, it expects me to have a feeling inside, and those feelings are supposed to be concretized in the Maisa HaMitzvah that I do. Those are supposed to help gear me toward fostering that feeling. Line 52. The specific physical performances are prescribed by the halacha as the external symbol of the exalted mood. Why am I sitting in the sukkah? Why am I drinking wine on Sukkot? Why am I lighting the Hanukkah candles? Well, to most people, you're lighting because that's what the halacha tells me to do. You read through the Shulchan Aruch. This is what I'm supposed to do. X, Y, and Z. Pick up the lulav and esrog. Shake it around. This way. Make the bracha then. Make the bracha here. Stand up when you do this mitzvah. Sit down when you do that one. That's not what it's about. Those are expressions of what a person is feeling. It's an external symbol of the exalted mood. What am I feeling inside? Well, when you take the lulav and esrog, that's just an expression of everything that's bubbling over inside of your heart, inside of your mind. It's supposed to be the way to bring about, in a concrete way, the feelings that a person feels inside, and it goes in the other direction as well. Line 53. The same is true of Avelis, the norm commanding one to mourn for one's deceased relatives. I think these are probably from the most commonly asked shilas in the year. People have so many very particular and specific questions about Avelis. Am I allowed to go here? Am I allowed to do that? Am I allowed to do the other thing? How many times, I don't know everybody else, but I've been asked so many times about an avel going to a movie. So you say, well, it's not really music. I don't know. It's a movie. But is that... If the reason why you're not supposed to hear music during the year of Avelis is because your life is supposed to be having a very serious mood at this time, I would imagine that going to a movie is no less than listening to music. Now again, it's a very difficult question to draw the line. How do you figure out what is considered part of the Hilchos Avelis and what is not? And every time I've called my father with any of these very delicate questions, he's always told me, well, it depends on the motivation. All of this depends on the motivation. Why are you going to the Simcha? Are you going to the Simcha because you want it to everyone else because you want to celebrate, or are you going to the Simcha because you feel that the other side really needs you to be there? Because it would mean so much to them, and it would be devastating to them if you weren't there. It's very much dependent on motivation, because Avelis is not just a cut-and-dry set of halachas that, oh, sit on the floor when you're in Shiva. How often do we walk into a Shiva house, and we see the Avelim are sitting on the floor, no shoes on, they haven't showered in a week, they're doing all the steps, all the things, but yet they're joking around with everybody that's there. That's not what Avelis is. That's not what Shiva's for. You miss the boat of what the Shiva's all about. The Shiva is just an expression of how to bring yourself into the mood for what you're supposed to be feeling inside. You're sitting on the floor and not wearing shoes and not showering does nothing for you if you're just sitting in the Shiva house and joking around the whole time. That does nothing. You miss the boat of what Avelis is all about. Says of Soloveitchik. Line 54, the same is true of Avelis, the norm commanding one to mourn for one's deceased relative. A mourner who has complied scrupulously with the ritual of Avelis but remained unresponsive and unaffected by his encounter with death. You can sit on the floor, you can take off your shoes, you cannot shower for a week, you can grow your hair long and everything else you're supposed to do, but if you haven't thought, if you remain unresponsive and unaffected by the encounter with death, it meant nothing to you. It didn't alter, it didn't change your lifestyle at all. It did nothing to change the course of your activity in your daily life. If the passing of this next of kin did not fill him with gloom, that person has failed to fulfill a precept of mourning. You don't understand what Avelis is, because Avelis is a dual responsibility. On the one hand, it's sit on the floor, do all the activities that the halacha dictates for you, but that's supposed to engender a feeling inside. And the same with Simchas Yomtiv. At the same time, a mourner who neglects the observance of the externals, so let's say you have somebody who's in Avelis, who's just crying, who's morbid, who's feeling terrible about it does affect them, but they don't do the acts, but they're busy sitting in the jacuzzi all day long. So, you also have not fulfilled your obligation of Avelis, because there's a duality here. On the one hand, you're supposed to have a feeling, on the same time, you're supposed to follow the strict letter of the law, of the way the halacha guides you to bring those feelings about. If the halacha says you're not supposed to be bathing and showering in the period of Avelis, so then it doesn't matter what you're feeling inside, that's not what you're supposed to do. It doesn't matter in the flip side, if you're sitting on the floor and not showering, but if you don't really express yourself in a way that an Avel is supposed to be expressing themselves, you've missed the opportunity to experience Avelis as well. At the same time, a mourner who neglects the observance of the externals is derelict of his duty, even though he lived through the horror and dismay of coming face to face with nihility. Again, that's what much of our mitzvah observance is supposed to be, that duality. The Ribbono Shel Olam really would have loved to give us the chance and opportunity to just sit and meditate and contemplate and think all day long and experience the feeling of having Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem and Yichud Hashem and Amun Abba Hashem, but he knows that that's not a reality for most of us. He knows that that is not something that is a possibility for most of us. And therefore, he put a concrete way, an actional experience for us to express ourselves in that way. You know, I think so often when we say slichus, so we say slichus during Aseres Yemei Tshuva, and we say slichus on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and you look around the shul, I don't know, maybe I'm a bad boy, I look around instead of looking in the sitter, but sometimes I look around the shul and you just see people, you know, sitting like this, you know, shaking the thing, and you're bowing down here, bowing down there. You watch people during modem sometimes, you know, they have a cell phone in one hand, in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei, holding a cell phone, you know, trying to make sure nobody notices them as they're checking their messages or whatever they're doing. Oh, bowing, clapping, you know, this, that, three steps forward, three steps back. What is that? What is that Shemoneh Esrei? Is the experience of tshuva during Aseres Yemei Tshuva just supposed to be the clapping and the banging and the three steps forward and the three steps back and the bowing down and the standing up and the getting on the floor? That's what it is? You can do all of that and miss the boat of what Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and Aseres Yemei Tshuva is all about. It's so easy for us to do that because we get lost in the action. We get lost in, oh, Shulchan Aruch says, this is what you have to do. Slach lanu, you bang your chest. Anach nekorim, we get down on the floor. We got to get up early in the morning to say slichos. I remember when I was in YU, they used to have a sign that told you what time davening was in a location. There were like 25 binyanim in the morning, options for everybody. But what bothered me was not the fact that there were so many options. What bothered me was that some of the minyanim wrote an end time. How do you have an end time for davening? What does it mean? It means we've timed it, and we know that this is how long we're going to take for this. And what if, chalila, you have one more ounce of kavan in your Shemona Esrei that day, and then we're going to go over? What's going to happen? How can you have an end time for davening? What does that mean? What does the experience mean to you? It means you have measured the amount of pages that you need to flip. You figured out how long it takes you to say each one or to skip through every other word. And you figured out what time we're going to finish davening. How can that be? You've missed the experience of davening. You don't understand what it means. It's like the person who sits and opens the slichas and flips all the pages and doesn't understand what they're saying, and it means nothing to them. Someone had a great point to me this week. There was a chazan who davened for the yamah this week, very slowly. I loved it. Most of the people really were upset. And it was on Asar B'Tevis when davening was longer as is. So most of the people were really unhappy, and somebody came over to me in shul to express his frustration. I totally understand. And he said to me a point that was 100% right. He said, why are we going so slowly through the slichos that I don't understand a word of what I'm saying anyway? I may as well go through it quickly and not understand the word. So it was a good point. And why is it a good point? Because I told him the Shulchan Aruch says like you. The Shulchan Aruch says, Tov lomar ma'at bekavana mi lomar harbe shalo bekavana. You're right. Leave out all the slichos. Don't understand the words. Say one paragraph of the slichas and think about every word that you're saying as opposed to trying to conquer the whole thing and fly through it. It means nothing. The Shulchan Aruch writes that. Tov lomar ma'at bekavana. It's better to say just a little bit and understand the words that you're saying. Mi lomar harbe shalo bekavana. We have nothing from that experience of reciting slichas. If we're just running through it, if we're just looking at the clock, if we're just trying to figure out how quickly we can do this, what does Asar B'Tevis mean to us? What do any of these slichas mean if we don't have the opportunity to savor the moment and understand exactly what it's supposed to do? Again, you always need to have that duality. Sometimes you find people nowadays who are so spiritual or mamish flying in the clouds, I don't know, their feet are not in the ground at all. And this is what the Noda Behuda expressed. The Noda Behuda writes in his tshuva, at the time there was a lot of fierce disagreement between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. Again, nowadays we don't have these problems because none of us are all, none of us are such great tzaddikim. There's not much to fight about. We're all just trying to hang on with the thread. So in the times when they really had serious disagreements, one of the Noda Behuda's objections was is that the Hasidim put a great emphasis on hachana. And before they went to do any mitzvah, they put a lot of time and effort into preparing themselves and making sure they were ready mentally and physically for the mitzvah they were about to do. Now, the Noda Behuda said, it's very nice, you want to do that, but the problem is you can say all the Shem Yichas, but by the time you get around, after all your hachanas, you miss this man kriyashma, you miss this man tefillah. So again, you have to have, on the one hand, the chassidish of feeling, you need to have the hachana, you need to get yourself in the right frame of mind to understand what it is that you're about to do. But at the same time, you cannot neglect the fact that the halacha gave very strict guidelines of how those actional mitzvahs are supposed to be performed. You can have all the feelings of Avos Hashem in the world. If you miss Man Kriyashma, you miss Man Kriyashma. You got nothing. If you daven after this Man Tefillah, you're after this Man Tefillah. You have no points at all. You can love the Ribbono Shel Olam from here till tomorrow. But it's not going to do anything if you don't follow the way that the Torah prescribes us to express those feelings. Yes?
You assume that everybody has a capacity to be able to look into themselves during sleep. And you see, you're making assumptions because this is your love. Your relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam is your love. And you're coming from your theoretical orientation. But if you see the words of the Rav is really being, he's going back to him being an existentialist. And he's trying to say that we need something tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody can say slichos, whether or not they can read the Hebrew. I mean, a lot. You watch people.
Right.
People lack the capacity to be able to really put themselves into tefillah. The cell phone has become the greatest toy in shul, all ages.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is, and who knows if you have the Hillamon, and people look, they say, oh, I'm Shmona Esrei, I'm davening.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if you went into the Y-based measures, it would be the same thing.
Right.
But just because this is your love and your passion, and when you say slichos, you really understand the meaning of it. There are plenty of people, they're there because they're there. And they said, their wife said, their kids said, they're there.
Myself included. I think part of the problem is
to external factors,
mm-hmm.
that it's so hard for them to say, I'm here because I really want to be here.
I think that's why it's important to read through a piece like this, where the Rav brings it to our consciousness. You're 100% right. I include myself. I'm not putting on anybody else.
The existential and the tangible.
Okay.
This was his love. He couldn't imagine how people would be able to concentrate on anything else.
I think it's important to expose ourselves, at least, to remind ourselves.
I say the tangible
Right.
Not so people would say, oh, it's ego.
Okay. 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 So let's bring another point relevant to what the Rav says here. You take, for example, we have a Gemara Maseches Sota Daf Yudalet. The Gemara learns the pasuk says, "Acharei Hashem Elokecha Teilechu." You have an obligation, says the Gemara, to walk, to follow after the Ribono Shel Olam. Ask the Gemara, how can it be? Don't we know the pasuk says, "Ki Hashem Elokecha Eish Ochlahu"? If somebody gets too close, you're going to be consumed by the fire, by the awesomeness, by the experience of being too close to God. Says the Gemara, it's not to be taken literally. Doesn't mean you should walk hand in hand with God. That's an impossibility. What it means is you should emulate the ways of God. Says the Gemara, listen to the examples. Mahu menachem avelim. Just like God is so compassionate, he goes and he's menachem avel, so too we should do the same. Mahu kover mesim. Just like God himself went ahead and buried Moshe Rabbeinu, so too we should do the same. Mahu malbish arumim. Just like God provided clothing for Adam and Chava when they felt naked, so too, afata malbish arumim, you should have compassion to go ahead and provide the homeless with who don't have shelter, who don't have clothing, who don't have the bare necessities of life. We should do the same thing. That's what the Gemara says. And yet we know that every word in the Torah is measured, and every word in the Torah is so important and is so carefully stated. And here, the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos Kuf Lamed Gimel learns the very same idea from yet another pasuk. Not from the pasuk that we learn in Maseches Sota Daf Yudalet. There we learn from the pasuk, Acharei Hashem Elokecha Teilechu. Here we have the Gemara learning from the pasuk that we say every day in Az Yashir, Ze Keli Vanvehu. And the Gemara says the word Vanvehu means Heve Domelo, Ani Vehu. Vanvehu can be broken down. Ani Vehu means me and God. Mahu, says the Gemara, Rachel Mechanan, just like God is caring, compassionate, and benevolent, Afata Rachel Mechanan, so too you should be caring, compassionate, and overly benevolent to other people as well. And the question is very obvious. Why do we need two psukim to teach us the very same idea? Rav Soloveitchik expressed in other contexts that perhaps the reason why the Torah has to learn from two different psukim the very same lesson is because it's addressing two different people. Sometimes, he said, you have a person who is such a doer, who's such a go-getter, who's malbish arumim, who's menachem avelim, who's kover mesim, on the chever kadisha, on the hatzala, and again, I'm not taking away from any of them. What they do is amazing. But they're such doers, they sometimes, unfortunately, become callous to what it is that they're doing. And that's the challenge that we all face. Sometimes you watch a doctor who's involved in such avodas hakodesh. A doctor has the opportunity all day, every day of his life to just help people out. And yet the doctor sometimes, when they have to tell you the bad news about some prognosis, they come in, cut and dry, say, oh, by the way, just want you to know, we look through the records and this is what you have and you have 6 months to live. The whole family stands there and says, what do you mean? How do you talk like that? What about our feelings? What about our family? The answer is, this doctor became so used to doing chesed, sometimes they lose the feeling of being a Rachel Mechanim. Sometimes they have a callous feeling toward the work that they're doing. Again, it's a difficult balance because if they would sit and break down every time they had to break the news to a patient about the terrible illness that they might have, they probably wouldn't be able to do their job. It's a very hard balance to strike. But the Torah says here, you're expected on the one hand to do the actional mitzvahs, the kover mesim, the menachem avelim, the malbish arumim, but at the same time to be a Rachel Mechanim as well. And it goes in the other direction. Sometimes you have people who can see, who can read the news and see how terrible life is for some people out there, and you can see how much people are suffering from a terrorist activity that's taking place somewhere in the world. You can see and you can cry and your heart goes out to them and you feel terrible and you say to yourself, what am I going to do? I'm just a simple person living in Woodmere. What's for me to do? What am I going to do already? I can be a Rachel Mechanim all I want, but where's your Malbish Arumim? Where's your Menachem Avelim? Where is your Kover Mesim? Where's your action that comes forth from the feelings that you have? And that, said Rav Soloveitchik, is why the Gemara goes in two different contexts from two different psukim to teach us the very same lesson, because sometimes people divorce the two from each other. Sometimes people neglect to appreciate the fact that both of those need to work in tandem. You have a feeling inside of yourself, well, do something with that feeling. You feel that life is so terrible for the people who just lost their father yesterday in the terrorist act. You feel terrible for the people that are now Yisomim and Yisomos. What are you going to do about it? It's not only about giving money. What are you going to do? Write them a letter? You're going to do anything? You're going to pick up a phone and call them maybe? Don't think that it's out of your reach. If you feel terrible, do something about it. Be Menachem Avel. Be Kover Mason. Be Malbish Arum. And in the other direction as well, when you're being Menachem Avel, when you're being Kover Mason, when you're involved in mitzvah activities, make sure you have that sensitivity of being a Rachel Mechanan at the same time. And it's a very difficult thing to do, but this is what every mitzvah gives us the opportunity to feel and to think. not just to do the cut and dry act, but to think about what it is that we're doing as we perform that act. Let's continue on 63. The outer action required by the halacha in this group of experiential precepts is dramatic in nature. Here's such an important line. One does not just act, he acts something out. When we do an act of a mitzvah, we're not just acting. You're not just following the prescription that the Torah gave us. You're not just looking in the Shulchan Aruch and saying, oh, this is what I do, hold the shofar this way, and blow the shofar that way, and make sure it's this long. No, you're not just acting, you're acting something out. The shofar is supposed to be acting out the feeling that we all have inside of ourselves. The lighting the Hanukkah candles is supposed to be acting out the feelings of gratitude, of hodah that we all have for the miracles that we experience in our lives. It's not just acting, it's acting out. It's expressing a feeling that we have. The dominant theme of the performance is a great, exciting story. The action is kerygmatic, which means it preaches in such a way, message-bearing. It tells a tale of the human mind and heart, of something wondrous or tragic that occurred in the deep recesses of the eye. It is filled with eagerness on the part of the doer to unburden himself of the emotional load pressing on his failed personality. The action is vehement and fervent, and in his rush and earnestness we see the consuming passion, a soul frightened and exalted, believing and rebelling, making a heroic effort to express the inexpressible. That's what we do every time we perform a mitzvah. We try to express that which is inexpressible. We try to concretize and to put into action the feelings that we feel inside that are so difficult for us to express otherwise. In describing the act of mitzvah performance, you'll say, well, if that's true, that actional mitzvahs are now seemingly cut and dry because everybody's asked to do the same thing. Rav Soloveitchik says that presents a major challenge because you'll say, well, then what good am I? You're shaking the lulav, I'm shaking the lulav. You're lighting candles, I'm lighting candles. What's the difference? What's the point? What do we need to do this for? If there's no self-expression, why am I doing what I'm doing? What does God care for my mitzvah that I'm going to do? Says Rav Soloveitchik, line 75, there is technique in painting. We all know that there's an art to art. The proper selection and use of colors, the expert strokes of the brush, and so on. Yet the painting as a piece of art is something different from all these details. You have a paint night, right? And the instructor comes there and tells everybody exactly how to do it. But yet, for some reason, my wife's painting is always going to look better than mine. Or going to look different than mine. Not better. Why is that? We all follow the same instructions. The instructor told me, mix this with that and stroke here and stroke there and it's going to look beautiful. But how come it doesn't come out the same? Because everybody appreciates the fact that it depends on your proficiencies. It depends how you stroke the brush, and it depends how you mix the paints. It's going to look very different, even though we're all following the same instructions. Line 78. It can never be integrated through a piecemeal additive process, combining the various phases of the execution of details of the artistic work. It is the personal element, the talent of the artist, the instantaneous creative spark that makes the work worthwhile from an artistic viewpoint. And here again, he says, is what it means when we perform a mitzvah. Yes, the Torah prescribes exactly how to do it, but don't think that that sucks out all of the feeling, all of the individuality that we're supposed to be having when we perform a mitzvah. A similar perspective illuminates the Kiyum HaMitzvah. It is something personal, intimate, and indefinable. Why? Because the same way when a person works on a piece of art, it's going to come out differently than somebody else's. When you work on your tefillah, when you work on your mitzvah, when you shake your lulav, when you listen to your shofar, it's an expression of the feelings that you have inside, not the expressions of somebody else. And the same way an artist's expressions are going to come out very differently than somebody else who happens to be sitting next to them and trying to do the same piece of art, so too the mitzvah activity that I'm involved in will come out and be expressed very differently, even though we're all saying the same words, even though we're all following the same instructions. It's going to come out very differently because the mitzvah experience is one which, as he writes, is an intimate and indefinable, a personal experience that we all go through. Now he moves on to the essence of tefillah. All that was just the introduction. Line number 85. In other words, prayer constitutes a basic method of religious representation. It is a mode of representing a sublime mood through sensuous form, a kind of physical portrait of miscible mingled experiences. Prayer is the tale of an aching and yearning heart. So when you daven, you're not just opening the siddur, flipping the pages, following the Shulchan Aruch's rules of how to daven, but it's the tale of an aching and yearning heart. This is the way of expressing what's going on inside of oneself. We must discriminate between two aspects of tefillah. Number one, the external one, constituting the formal act of prayer. And number two, the inner experience, which expresses the very essence of the mitzvah. Okay, so tefillah is made up of also both of these components. You have on the one hand the formal act, the zman tefila, the way to say it, which nusach you daven, exactly how you daven and when you daven during the day. And then you have the more important part, which is the essential, the essence of prayer, and that is how you express what you're feeling inside. The physical deed of reciting a fixed text serves only as a medium through which the experience finds its objectification and concretion. It is not to be identified with the genuine act of praying. The genuine act of praying is what a person feels inside, which is to be found in an entirely different dimension, namely, in the great, wondrous God experience. What I find amazing about this, as you mentioned very correctly before, is that Rav Soloveitchik really believed this. When Rav Soloveitchik davened, he understood that this is what it is. It's an expression of one's inner feelings, of one's yearning and aching heart. That's really what he believed was supposed to be felt at the time that he did. And you'll say, it's difficult for most of us to feel in such a way. It's difficult. It's not our passion. It's not our love. But the reason I bring this to our attention is because this is the way it's supposed to be. This is what we should look forward to. This is what we should try to build ourselves toward. And this is why I think it's important that we had a few weeks of trying to express what the essence of tefillah is supposed to be, what the essence of prayer is supposed to mean. Line 98. Kavana, when performing a general mitzvah, as we have noted, generally requires only normative heedfulness or motivation on the part of the doer. That is to say, the intention to discharge one's duty in the accord with God's will, which constitutes an integral part of the religious gesture. The Gemara has a discussion whether mitzvah tzrichas kavana. Do I have to have in mind when I shake the lulav that I'm shaking the lulav because God told me today on the first day of Sukkot to shake the lulav? Or do I just have to do the act and that's good enough? That's a discussion. Line 104. As far as tefillah is concerned, all agree that the physical performance divorced from the inner experience is worthless. All agree as far as tefillah is concerned. Read that again. All agree, line 104, that the physical performance divorced from the inner experience is worthless. And he quotes the Rambam. The Rambam writes, prayer without kavana is no prayer at all. Prayer without kavana is no prayer at all, says the Rambam. The man who has prayed without kavana is duty-bound to recite his prayer over again. Now, there's no reason to recite the prayer over again if you're going to do the same thing the second time as you did the first. But again, the point that the Rambam's making is, like he said, is that tefillah, everybody agrees when it comes to tefillah that performing the act itself, but divorcing it from the inner experience, from the feeling, is worthless. It's a meaningless act. Line 109. For kavana with respect to tefillah forms the very core of the act. Without it, without understanding what we're doing, without having kavana that we're standing, lifnei melech malchei amlachem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, prayer would become a meaningless and stereotyped ceremonial. Soloveitchik spoke a lot about this, how we have to be careful not to ceremonialize Judaism. And it's something that he spoke about a lot. He said that the halacha tells us how we're supposed to perform mitzvahs, and if you don't go in accordance with that, it means you're just looking at the mitzvah as a ceremony. You're not really doing the mitzvah because the halacha dictates you to perform a mitzvah in a particular way. Someone called me with a shaila recently. It's not important what all the details were, but basically he was asked to serve as a sandik at a conservative bris where they were having a female rabbi being the mohelet. So I'm not judging. Okay, you have people who choose to go on that path. And he asked me what he should do. It's somebody who he was very closely connected with, and if he would say no to such a kibud, he would be very much offending the other person. And I told him, I can't take on such a question myself, I don't know. So I called Mother to ask him what he thought. And my father's objection was not so much to the very simple objections that probably many of us would have had, but it was more to the fact that you're just making a mockery out of what a bris milah is. You're just ceremonializing the ceremony. You're making it into no longer a ma'aseh hamitzvah. Now it's just a joke. Because you're not following the rules of what a bris milah is supposed to be. You schedule a bris milah not on the day when it's supposed to be. You just schedule it when it's convenient for everyone. You get somebody who's not supposed to be doing the bris. Again, we're not judging what they did. What they did is what they did. That's their way of life. That's what they do. It's not for us to judge anybody. But the question is, for me to participate in such an act means I'm not appreciating what it means to have a bris milah. I'm not appreciating what the act means when we do it. It makes a joke out of when we do it in our way. And that, I think, is an important pointer. Soloveitchik said it many times about many different things that we do. You know, you go to a place 2 weeks before Hanukkah, and you have a Hanukkah party, and you light the Hanukkah candles at the Hanukkah party. Again, you might be in the president's house. Very nice. But it means that you don't understand what lighting Hanukkah candles is. It's like blowing the shofar on Pesach. It's like eating matzah on Rosh Hashanah. It doesn't mean anything. If that's the way we're going to act, if we're just going to do everything because it feels nice, because it looks nice, because it happens to impress others, that's just making a ceremony out of what our mitzvahs really represent to us, of what our mitzvahs really mean. And here Rav Soloveitchik goes on, 111. Hence, the kavana concerning tefillah must express itself not in a mere duty awareness, but in an all-embracing and an all-penetrating transcendental experience. That's the way he experienced every time he got up to daven. One turns toward God with their heart and not merely with the lips, with their thoughts and not only words. Skip down to line 117. If kavana does not represent inward devotion or commitment, it is deprived of significance. No religious performance has occurred. Okay, if a person gets up to daven without kavana, without understanding what they're saying, without thinking about the fact that they're standing in front of the Ribono Shel Olam, who is the all-powerful, the almighty, then they have lost the essence of what tefillah really is. And here Rav Soloveitchik sums it all up, line 120, to review the central point. The very essence of tefillah expresses itself in a romance rather than in a disciplined action. How many of us think of tefillah as a romance? Romance. That's not the description I would have given. But when you think about it, if tefillah is really the greatest expression of what one is feeling so overwhelmingly inside of themselves, it is a romance. It makes a lot of sense. The same way one tries to express that to a spouse or to a child, to somebody that they love so much that they're very connected with. That's what tefillah is every day. It's a romance. The very essence of tefillah expresses itself in a romance rather than a disciplined action, in a great passionate yearning rather than a limited cold achievement, in a movement of the soul rather than a performance of the soul, in an awareness rather than an inaction, in an inner longing rather than a tangible performance, in silence rather than in loud speech. As we emphasized above, the external elements are indispensable. You have to follow the halacha. You have to do what it says. You have to go by the Zman Tefillah, since the halacha always operates with a double series, the subjective and the objective. Certainly one who does not correlate the experience with an objective symbol, in this case, the recital of the words, again, if you sit on your couch and just think about God all day, you have not been mekayem the mitzvah of tefillah. But if you sit in shul all day and say the words without thinking about God, that's just as silly as sitting on your couch and not saying the words either. Is remiss in his duty. However, the external act is clearly but a side. The external act of saying the words, argues Rav Soloveitchik, is just a side. It's incidental. A formal side of the full state of mind. It's the feeling that's so much more the essence of tefillah than the words themselves. Now again, we comply with the formal rules of how exactly we're supposed to do a mitzvah, but never allow that to take away from what the experience is supposed to mean to you, how one is supposed to connect, what the feeling one is supposed to have. So as we started, the Rambam and the Ramban have a very detailed technical disagreement whether or not tefillah is a biblical mitzvah or just a rabbinic in its very nature. Either way, everybody agrees that tefillah is something which is very important. Like the Ramban says, even I agree, the Ramban argues, that be'es tzar, when a person finds himself in a state of emergency, in a state of urgency, a person has to daven because at an es tzar, that's what we're asked to do. The Rambam argues, every moment of life is an es tzar. Every moment of life is so unpredictable. Every moment of life is so fickle, and we should always feel that every moment of life is an es tzar. And that's why the Rambam argues we have a mitzvah, biblically, to daven every single day, because every day is a great state of emergency. But one has to realize that as much as tefillah might or might not be very much a part of the Taryag mitzvahs, it is certainly not to be treated like many of the other mitzvahs. It is something that is, what Rav Soloveitchik writes, a very personal, a very intimate, a profound, a concealed experience. It's something that's supposed to be a romance. It's something where a person is supposed to feel, I have the opportunity to express myself, to express my love, to express my feelings. And when we have a tefillah that is divorced of that dimension, when we have a tefillah that doesn't incorporate all of those feelings and all of those expressions, that tefillah, like the Rambam says, is meaningless. Because a tefillah without kavana, everybody agrees, is not an act at all. It's not a religious experience. No religious performance has occurred, said Rav Soloveitchik, when you have a tefillah that is offered in such a way. So, Amir Tashem, next week.